The world is in the midst of a crisis not less serious than that of the Great War. While it was inevitable that the period following the war should be fraught with grave problems for civilization, these problems have been made much more difficult by the presence of a new danger, namely the destructive force of Bolshevism. Russia was the first victim of what proved to be a movement of an international character, Russia being used as the base of operations. While powerful Bolshevist armies are overrunning Asia and menacing the European countries to the west, an equally dangerous force of Red propagandists, directed from Moscow, is operating on several continents, spreading its social poison throughout the world and threatening the destruction of the social and industrial morale of the civilized nations. With the triumph of the Bolshevist Revolution in Russia, a group of internationalists, most of whom were members of the Jewish race, seized the machinery of government and have held it ever since. The complete destruction of Russian civilization, which for centuries had been essentially a Christian civilization, and the reduction of the great majority of the Russian people to a state of abject misery and ruin are accomplished facts. The Bolshevist leaders, however, not content with this destruction and the establishment of a cruel despotism in Russia, are making every effort to extend their revolution and their control to other countries. The communist revolution in Hungary under Bela Cohen, alias Kuhn, a confessed ally and agent of Trotsky, was not terminated until it had wrought great havoc in that country. The same is true of the Spartacan revolt in Germany, where recently the struggle broke out anew and assumed the character of a formidable civil war. Holland and Italy are today seriously threatened with uprisings inspired by the Bolsheviki, while in France the government has been compelled to expel the Bolshevist agents in large numbers. In the United States, revolutionary agitation directly guided and fomented by agents of Lenin and Trotsky and subsidized with ample funds recently reached such proportions that the federal government was forced to take strong measures, including hundreds of arrests and deportations. The enemy is in our midst. In this country, as elsewhere, alien agitators who are either Bolshevists themselves or emissaries of the Bolsheviki have wormed their way into some of the loyal labor organizations, or put themselves at the head of the socialist or other radical political parties, artificially stimulating social unrest and seeking to turn industrial strikes into political upheavals, leading to revolution and anarchy. Shall America be as slow to realize the real danger of international Bolshevism as she was to recognize the menace of German imperialism? Shall America again be unprepared? We must be ready to meet the danger at our doors and, if necessary, to suppress it in our midst with physical force, just as was necessary in the struggle with the Prussian militarism. It has been said, however, and perhaps truly, that Bolshevism cannot be met by force alone. Certainly, to meet it effectively, its nature must be understood. To this end, it is necessary to analyze the movement carefully and to discover its underlying causes and, if possible, the predominating cause. From the very beginning, there was an element of mystery in the Bolshevist Revolution in Russia. Was it essentially an attempt to put into effect the principles of international socialism as promulgated by Karl Marx? Was it a disguised form of proletarian imperialism? Did it aim at the complete destruction of Christian civilization? Or finally, was it a long-planned, gigantic revolt of the Jewish race against Christendom and its institutions? From the very start, there was a terrible method in the madness of Trotsky and those in league with him. Many of their moves, which at the time seemed inexplicable, afterwards appeared logical enough when their objects became apparent. The world was puzzled by Trotsky's famous remark at Brest-Litovsk, when he said, "No peace, no war." Later, however, the real meaning became known. No war on Germany, no peace for Russia or the rest of the world. That the Bolshevist Revolution was from the beginning almost entirely led and controlled by Jews is a fact which has gradually thrust itself upon the attention of the world. The Jews, in many instances, have admitted the dominating role which members of their race have played in an international Bolshevism and have sought to defend it. Some of their recognized leaders have proclaimed their pride in Trotsky. The fact that the Jewish race has taken such an active part in the Russian Bolshevist movement, with its international ramifications, had been attributed in some quarters to the motive of revenge on the part of the Jews for what they regard as a long era of persecution. If this be so, is it impossible that Jews in various parts of the world imagine that now is their chance not only for revenge but for world domination? The air of confidence with which Trotsky and other Jewish leaders are proceeding with their drastic program in Russia is significant. Significant also is the enthusiastic support which is being given to the Soviet rule by various Jewish elements and groups outside of Russia. Whether this correlated movement of the Jews in support of Bolshevism is not being carried out on some concerted plan is a question of importance which warrants careful study and investigation. No facts which can possibly throw light upon this question should be disregarded. For this reason, it is timely to consider the contents and origin of a document of extraordinary interest, which, though made public in Russia some 15 years ago, is generally unknown elsewhere. The document referred to is entitled, quote, "The Protocols of the Meetings of the Zionist Men of Wisdom," end quote, and was published for the first time in 1905 at Sarkozy Selo in a Russian book entitled, quote, "The Great in the Little," end quote, written by Sarge Nihlus, a well-known Russian author. The protocol set forth a comprehensive program for the substantial destruction of all Christian states and proposed certain practical methods for achieving world domination by the Jewish nation. So far as is known, the protocols have never been repudiated publicly by recognized Jewish authorities. Quite recently, the well-known firm of Arian Spottiswood Limited, printers for the British government, published a pamphlet under the title, quote, "The Jewish Peril, Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion," end quote. In the preface of this pamphlet, it is explained that the protocols referred to were translated from the Russian into English from Sarge Nihlus's book, which appeared in Russia in 1905. While the editors do not give the title of Nihlus's book, they say, quote, "A copy of the original may be seen at the British Museum Library under number 3926-D-17, stamped British Museum, 10th of August, 1906. They state also that the publication of the English pamphlet at present is justified by the growing menace of Bolshevism throughout the world. The pamphlet concludes with the warning, "Gentiles, beware," end quote. It seems obvious that the publishers, Arian Spottiswood Limited, have used Nihlus's book, The Great and the Little, published in Russia in 1905. A specific reference to the protocols is to be found also in the French weekly magazine, La Ville, France, number 160, published in February 1920. In the editorial article entitled "The Jews Have Created Bolshevism," pages 10 through 13, the following extract from the Zionist Protocols as published by Nihlus is given in French. The article asserts that Bolshevism is nothing but a phase of Judaism and also states that the Jewish Bolshevist leaders in Russia were subsidized by Jewish banking houses in the United States and Germany. In January 1917, Mr. Nihlus published another book under the title "It Is Near at the Door," and in the book the protocols were again published in full. A reproduction of the title page of this book is inserted at the beginning of this volume. While the protocols are generally unknown here, it is worthy of note that on October the 27th, 28th, 1919, the Philadelphia Public Ledger printed long excerpt from them in an article calling the attention of the American people to the document and to the terrible program which it presents. The article in the Ledger was somewhat misleading, however, since it was published under the captions, quote, "Red Bible," end quote, and, quote, "Bolshevist propaganda," end quote. All words in the text itself indicating that the protocols were of Jewish origin were omitted. The Hebrew word goyes, signifying Gentiles, used in the protocols, nowhere appears in the Ledger article. Furthermore, wherever in the protocols the expressions "our people" or "we," meaning the Jewish people or the Jews, are used, the author of the article makes it clear that the people thus referred to are the Bolshevists and speaks of the protocols as a Russian document, which clearly it is not. Mr. Nihlus shows that the protocols came into his hands in 1901. In 1901, the Bolshevist Party did not exist, for it was founded only in 1903 and was not really organized for work until several years later. Nowhere in the protocols does the word Bolshevist appear. While the word Jews is used many times, although the writer more frequently uses the word we when speaking of the Jews, there is only one hypothesis upon which the protocols could possibly be considered Bolshevist, namely, that the Bolshevist movement was of Jewish origin, in which case the plan outlined in the protocols might have become Bolshevist by adoption. The very fact that a document purporting to be written by a Jew for Jews could be so easily described as Bolshevist propaganda is of interest. Now, for the first time, the document entitled by Mr. Nihlus, quote, Protocols of the Meetings of the Zionist Men of Wisdom, end quote, is published in full in the United States, correctly translated from the Russian. For this purpose, we have used the Russian text as it appears in Mr. Nihlus's book, It Is Near at the Door, 1917, published in the printing office of the Vyatotrotsky Monastery. Before proceeding to examine the contents of the protocols, let us briefly give Mr. Nihlus's account of the way in which they came into his possession and of his views in regard to their origin. Mr. Nihlus, at pages 86 to 92 of his book, It Is Near at the Door, states that he received the manuscript containing the protocols of the meetings of the Zionist Men of Wisdom in 1901 from Mr. Alexis Nikolaevich Sokotin, at one time Marshal of Nobility in the district of Kern, Central Russia, and later Vice Governor of the Government of Stavropol, South Russia, and that when giving the manuscript to Mr. Nihlus, Mr. Sokotin said, quote, Take it into your full possession. Read it. Become inspired and make out of it something useful to the Christian soul. Otherwise, it might remain with me unused. From a political standpoint, it is useless, for it is too late to act on it. From a spiritual standpoint, however, it might be otherwise. In your hands, with God's help, it will bear fruit, end quote. Mr. Nihlus states that Mr. Sokotin told him that the manuscript was originally obtained by a lady whose name is not given and who, he said, obtained it in a mysterious way. Mr. Nihlus showed it to several Russians of high standing, one of whom said, quote, Slavdom has not yet spoken its last word, and therefore no matter how cunning and strong the Zionist men of wisdom may be, their efforts are doomed to failure, and for this reason there is no need to despair, end quote. Mr. Nihlus states that prior to 1905, he submitted the protocols to the Grand Duke Sarge Alexandrovich, who, having examined them, sent him a message of two words only, quote, too late, end quote. Subsequently, Mr. Nihlus made several attempts to call the attention of the proper officials to the contents of this document, but without result. In 1905, he published the second edition of this book, The Great and the Little. In this edition, the protocols were for the first time incorporated. In his last book, Mr. Nihlus writes, quote, These protocols produced a scarcely noticeable impression upon the world outside of the Christian church. The periodical press, which is in the main in Jewish hands, are under the guidance and influence of the Jews, sought to conceal their publication, scarcely mentioning them or referring to them as a fallacious invention or a fairy tale. Among loyal Christians, however, the protocols bore fruit and created a success for my book far greater than could have been anticipated, for they spread the knowledge of the hidden mysteries of our time in a wide circle to those belonging to the Christian family. Since then, my book, with all the protocols, has appeared in its fourth edition, but only now I learn authoritatively from Jewish sources that these protocols are nothing else than a strategic plan for the conquest of the world, putting it under the yoke of Israel, the struggler against God, a plan worked out by the leaders of the Jewish people during the many centuries of their dispersion, and finally presented to the Council of Elders by the Prince of Exile, Theodore Herzl, at the time of the first Zionist Congress summoned by him at Basel in August 1897, end quote. Again, he writes, end quote, In what way these documents constituting the Holy of Holies of the hopes of Israel, the century-old mystery of its leaders, reached the general mass of the uninitiated has not been ascertained. As already mentioned, they were given to me in 1901. In that year, in circular number 18, as well in others dispatched to the Zionists on behalf of the Zionist Actions Committee, Theodore Herzl stated that certain confidential information, notwithstanding the admonition, had not been kept secret and had been given undesirable publicity. Finally, Mr. Nihlus declares, in quote, "The protocols are signed by the Zionist representatives of the 33rd highest degree of initiation. These protocols were secretly removed from the complete file of protocols, which, as we now know, pertain to the first Zionist Congress held in Basel in August 1897. All this was taken from the secret vaults at the main Zionist office, which at present is located in French territory," end quote. In 1918, the protocols were again published in Russian by a book publishing firm, the Sentinel, at Novocherkassk, South Russia. The pamphlet referred to bears the title Zionist Protocols, the plans for the conquest of the universe by Judeo-Masons. In the introduction to the pamphlet, it is stated, "The protocols are a program carefully worked out in all its details for the conquest of the universe by the Jews. The greater part of this program has already been realized. And if we will not come back to our senses, we are inevitably doomed," end quote. In the concluding part of this introduction, the publisher states as follows, quote, "The protocols indeed are not only the key to our first unsuccessful revolution, but they are also the key to the second in which Jewry played such a sinister role for Russia. For us who are witnesses of the self-destruction of Russia, for us who hope for her regeneration, this document is all the more significant as it discloses the means of the enemies of Christendom for our enslavement. Only after having obtained the knowledge of the means, it may become possible to successfully combat the enemies of Christ and of Christian culture," end quote. There is not, and in the nature of the case, there hardly can be, any direct evidence as to the authenticity of the protocols. There is, however, a considerable body of facts having a bearing upon this question, which the publishers of this book put before the reader, leaving him to draw his own conclusions. The facts to which we refer may be roughly grouped under three heads. Quote, A. There is a remarkable similarity between the policies of destruction outlined in the protocols and the actual measures of destruction put into effect by the Bolshevist regime in Russia. And there is evidence that this regime is under the control of Jewish leaders. B. There is also a striking parallelism between certain passages in the protocols and the statements of recognized Jewish leaders, both religious and political, appearing in their published writings and speeches. C. Finally, certain Jewish activities outside of Russia coincide in a remarkable degree with certain parts of the protocols. In part two of this volume, evidence under these various heads is set forth. This evidence, however, can be intelligently considered only after a careful study of the protocols themselves, a translation of which appears in the following pages, preceded by a short summary prepared for the convenience of the reader.